Time and make sure we do our best to get everyone out of here as quickly as God allows. I'm excited and thrilled about what God's doing. I'm excited to see what God's going to do coming out of this fast. I definitely count it a huge privilege to be able to speak as we're ending this because I believe that God has something for all of us today. If you could turn your Bibles to Joshua chapter 15. I'm going to start at verse 16. Joshua chapter 15, verse 16. Says, "And Caleb said, He that smiteth Kireth Sepher and taketh it, to him I will give Aksa my daughter to wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, took it. And he gave Aksa his daughter to wife." Now a while ago I preached a message with an interesting title. And I'm going to do that again today. So just bear with me for a little bit. This morning I want to preach on the topic, the contrasting lives of the grasshopper and the mountain goat. You can be seated. It's a lot of silence and awkward laughing, and that's good because that means you don't know what I'm going to talk about. Calophera, more commonly called the grasshopper, are from the scientific order Orthoptera. The order itself is made up of over 2,400 different genera, and in those 2,400 different genera, there are over 11,000 different species of grasshoppers worldwide. Now, they grow on an average of about the size of 2 inches long. But it's fairly common to find them growing over 5 inches in length. With that, they can currently be found on every continent in the world except Antarctica. There's so many grasshoppers around the world that the conservation sites have their conservation status as quote-unquote, of least concern. Clearly, there's no problems with stepping on a grasshopper. With the grasshopper infestation that appears to be all over the globe, it isn't surprising that their existence is found in the art, in the writing, in the history of many different cultures across our time. And currently, they are still considered a protein staple in various parts of the world where other sources of protein are not readily available, like Africa and Asia. And it's this use as a protein that is one of our more popular references to grasshoppers in the Bible. We read where the diet of John the Baptist was referenced as containing locust and honey. Now, for the smart people who've caught onto this, it says locust and not grasshoppers. Well, we'll get into that a little bit later, but just to calm your worries that I see in some of you, the locust and the grasshopper come from the same mama and they come from the same egg. For those of you worried about how rough John the Baptist's life must have been, having to eat nothing but grasshoppers to survive, don't worry too much because apparently grasshoppers are considered quite yummy around our world. I've read that they are good dusted with chili powder, roasted with garlic, sprinkled with a little bit of lime juice, or better yet, ground up and made into a salsa, or dust in the outside of orange slices. It's supposed to be absolutely fantastic. Now, I do understand that everyone here is coming off a fast, and I'm showing you all these wonderful pictures of food. And if they've inspired you to do some shopping after service, you probably won't find them in your local grocery store. So you might have to look online. And if you're looking for grasshoppers online, you might have a little bit more luck shopping for them under the name Chapalunes. Yeah, don't ask if I said that right. Here's a pro tip for you grasshopper shoppers. The best way to get the best price on grasshoppers, it's all about timing. See, if you buy them shortly after they've been harvested, the price is relatively low. But as their resources start running out and the warehouses start emptying, the cost of grasshoppers becomes pretty expensive, oftentimes tripling as their supplies diminish. Now, for those of you who are looking forward to a good meal of grasshoppers, don't worry. I've already checked the prices for you. And I found a supply that you can get right now. Zacalito.com. You can get your chapalones for only $4 per ounce. To put that in perspective, if you were planning to fill your belly with a yummy 8-ounce ribeye, and instead you want to transplant that and put in the grasshoppers in there instead, you can get the same amount of tummy-filled satisfaction for only $32 for those 8 ounces of grasshoppers. Now, that may sound like a little bit, but these grasshoppers won't just be any grasshoppers. This 8 ounces of goodness will be seasoned and sautéed with lime, chili, and a garlic. Whew. If that doesn't get your mouth watering, I don't know what will. Now, we'll get back to the message here. And we won't actually be addressing grasshoppers in the way that John the Baptist used them. But I figured if Pastor is constantly up here flashing all the Snicker bars and Mountain Dews at us, I want to give everybody an alternative option for later today. So for those of you who are taking notes, feel free to add Zacalito.com to your shopping list. You can find it right up there. All right, instead of food, I want to focus on the other well-known reference to grasshoppers in the Bible. Numbers chapter 13, verses 30 to 33. It says, "And Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, 'Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it.' But the men that went up with him said, 'We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we.' And they brought up an evil report of the land, which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, 'The land through which we have gone to search it, it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof. And all the people that we saw in it are men of great stature. And there we saw giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers. And so we were in their sight.'" Now, for years, I must admit that when I read this, I always scratched my head at this reference made by the children of Israel. Why did they call themselves grasshoppers? What made them see themselves as grasshoppers? If they just saw themselves as tiny compared to the giants, why not say we saw ourselves as ants? That's a little bit smaller. Well, if they saw themselves as weak, why not say we saw ourselves as slugs? If they didn't think they fit in the promised land, why not? We're fish on land. There's tons of animals in the animal kingdom they could have chosen. So what was it about grasshoppers? The answer lies really in the overly simple life of the grasshopper. For all intents and purposes, the grasshopper lives a life completely void of direction or purpose. When we look at the animal kingdom, bees populate, ants prepare, all of nature serves a purpose of some kind or another. The grasshopper, its only purpose is to eat. It simply eats. It either eats until it dies, or it eats until it's eaten by something else. When we think about that side of it, the grasshopper's predators vary from very large to very small. And I could not find anywhere a complete list of the grasshopper's predators because the grasshopper is prey to pretty much everything that moves, including people. I did put together a list from some of the various sites I found, and some of the more common predators of grasshoppers are rats, spiders, every kind of bird, lizards, monkeys, bats, foxes, coyotes, snakes, mice, raccoons, fish, bees, beetles, crickets, ants, dragonflies, toads, frogs, hornets, fungus, bacteria, and even houseflies. I think it's safe to say that the defensive abilities of a grasshopper are lacking just a little bit. When we study those defensive abilities, we see that there's a few species around the world that have added a few defensive mechanisms. But while those other species have something else, for the most part, the defense of the grasshopper is limited to just jumping. And when I say jumping, that actually is giving the grasshopper a little too much credit. In fact, scientists do not say that grasshoppers jump at all. Instead, they say that grasshoppers catapult themselves. See, jumping implies that there was a sense of purpose, there's a direction, there's an idea of where they're going. The grasshopper just flings itself into the air, and if it hasn't formed wings yet, it lands where it lands. If it has wings, it tries to land somewhere safe. But in both cases, as a grasshopper lands, the fear of the danger is completely gone. Its only thought goes back to simply eating. If he doesn't land on a plant to eat, he continues to catapult himself over and over until he lands on a food source that it can once again devour. See, the grasshopper is completely driven by its belly. It's completely driven by its lust. And this brings us to the locust side of the grasshopper. See, when the grasshopper can't eat itself to death, and the food source that's around it becomes scarce, the chemical serotonin is released into the grasshopper, triggering emotional bursts of energy into their system. And with this emotional burst, they begin to reproduce faster, and they change their physical form, becoming larger and more aggressive. As the population continues to grow from this released chemical, they begin to form into a swarm and devouring everything they can find. They go from location to location, from place to place, until they've wiped out all food sources they can find, and the grasshopper or the locust die from starvation. It's this later, more aggressive form that is considered a locust. Now, I'm not sure if the Israelites understood the full ramifications of what they were saying, but by declaring that they saw themselves only as grasshoppers, they made one of the most accurate and profound comparisons possible for this current state. Well, I don't doubt for a second that the Israelites wanted their freedom from slavery. They didn't really want to be free from everything. The reality is, they didn't want to be free from their current master, which was their own lust. See, as we watch the nation of Israel travel to the promised land, they are constantly swinging to this side and that side, driven simply by the emotional swings of whatever's happening at the moment. We start up watching them living high on full bellies and full wallets as the Egyptians basically paid them to get out of their country, and the Israel's rejoicing. Just a little bit later, they're weeping as they think they're all dead men as the Egyptian army's tracking down behind them. Right after that, we find them once again rejoicing on the other side of the Red Sea, watching the army drown, once again filling their bellies with triumph. The emotional tides swing back as Moses is apparently on the mountaintop for too long, and they fill their religious need by making an image to worship. When they come to Mar to get a drink and find out the water isn't safe to drink, they turn back into the swarm of proverbial locusts, attacking Moses and God until their need is met. Over and over, the pattern repeats itself. No water, swarm until it comes out of a rock, we fill our bellies. No food, swarm until manna comes from heaven, we fill our bellies. Sick of manna, swarm until there's quail as far as the eye can see. And once again, we fill our bellies. It's a pattern that continues over and over again. You see, when Israel was in Egypt, when they first went there, they lived off the best of the land during the life of Joseph. They got used to the pleasantries. They got used to things being good. And when he died, the Egyptians made him slaves, but they had already been enslaved to their own lusts, living in that lap of luxury for too long. When we see all the things that they complained about in the wilderness, we come to realize that yes, they were slaves, but they weren't living in Egypt without their luxuries and without their niceties. It's one thing to murmur and complain about what's going on in our lives. We can look at things and say, I don't like this, I don't like that. But it's a whole different thing when we're asked to do something about it. See, their great-grandfathers may have understood how blessed they were with what they had in Egypt, with all the food, with all the resources, with the best of the lands of Goshen. But this generation that came out in the Exodus was four generations into the Egyptian lifestyle and mindset. It was a grasshopper mentality. Fill my belly before I turn into a destructive swarm. And it was a mentality that God could not allow to continue. As a result, for 40 years, Israel would be forced to wander through a wilderness until the grasshopper mentality had been completely destroyed and wiped out. There was a purging that had to happen, and that mindset had to be completely removed. the future of Israel was going to be given to a generation that was raised in the wilderness, not in Egypt. It was a generation that wasn't filling its bellies. It wasn't driven by their bellies. No more niceties, no more luxuries to depend on. They would learn what it meant to walk by faith, to trust on God's providence and to depend on His direction. It's a whole different mindset. This was a totally different thought process. Gone would be the grasshopper mentality. This generation would be defined by something totally different. They would take on the characteristics of the two men who didn't succumb to the swarming mentality the first time around. The only two men who could see beyond the thoughts and the fears of the swarm, and that was Joshua and Caleb. We know the stories of Joshua. They're some of the first ones we hear in Sunday school, fighting the battle of Jericho, conquering the promised land for the children of Israel, demanding all of them to take a stand and determine who they would serve. The Bible records that Israel served God until all the men who had been influenced by Joshua passed away. Joshua had hold of something powerful. See, Joshua couldn't have the grasshopper mentality. He couldn't be the victim because simply he was something else different. Joshua wasn't a victim, he was a conqueror. Now, as powerful as the testimony of Joshua is, I think it's a story of Caleb that provides even a more vivid representation of the mindset of a conqueror instead of the mindset of the victim. Joshua 14, verses 6 through 12 says, "And the children of Judah came unto Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, Thou knowest the thing that the Lord said unto Moses, the man of God, concerning me and thee in Kadesh Barnea. 40 years old was I when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought him word again as it was in mine heart. Nonetheless, my brethren that went up with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly followed the Lord my God. And Moses sware that day, saying, Surely the land whereon thy feet have trodden shall be thine inheritance and thy children's forever. Because thou hast wholly followed the Lord my God. And now, because the Lord has kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years, even since the Lord spake this word unto Moses while the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness. And now, lo, I am this day 85 years old. I'm 85 years old. As yet, I am as strong this day as I was the day Moses sent me. As my strength was then, even so is my strength now, both for war, both to go out and to come in. Now, therefore, give me this mountain, whereof the Lord has spake in that day. For thou heardest in that day how the Anakims were there, and that city, the cities were great and fenced. And if it be the Lord will be with me, then I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord has said." Now let's look at this. What Caleb was really saying was, "Hey Joshua, you remember those giants that scared us away? Let me at them. That mountain, that's my mountain. That's not theirs. Those cities, those are my cities. Those fortresses, those are my fortresses. We may have been wandering in the wilderness for the last few years, but I'm not living down where the grasshoppers live. My home is on the mountaintop." The enemy thought he won. He thought we ran away and went in hiding. But we're back now. We're stronger than we ever were. I didn't get weaker. I'm not tired. I'm not run down. I'm ready to fight. I still have the strength to go out to war, but better yet, I have the strength to come back. That means that I win. I don't come back a loser. I'm coming back with my victory. I'm not the one that is defeated. For 40 years, we've been preparing for this. We've cleaned up our stinking thinking. We're no longer driven by our lusts. Instead, we've learned that where God leads, that's where we follow. For 40 years, if the cloud moves, so did we. We haven't been pampered in the lap of luxury of Egypt. Instead, we've trusted Egypt to provide our needs. We've learned to depend on God to provide everything that we need. In short, we've lost the grasshopper mentality. Now let me get my mountain so I can be who God promised me I will be. I can no longer be defined by a generation of grasshoppers. I need to be up with the mountain goats. Now, I got to admit, when sometimes God speaks to me different ways, giving me messages. And this one, I was in the bathroom about to brush my teeth. I wasn't being spiritual at all. And he gave me the title. I'm like, really, God? What in the world does that mean? And he began to open up my mind and my understanding. And I must admit, a mountain goat was not the first animal that came to my mind when I was thinking about Caleb. Outside of sharing the same territory and the same living space, I didn't see Caleb as a goat. I scratched my head more than once, and I tried to, you know, maybe help God out. Maybe I heard it wrong. God, you said mountain lion, not goat, right? The guy who wants to go tear down the enemy camp. But each time, he kept pointing me back in the same direction. I'm a quick learner, so I stopped trying to correct God, and I started doing some studying. Araneus americanus, from the subfamily Capernaum, the tribe of Namor Hedini, the mountain goat, is the only member of the genus. It didn't take long in my research to find out that the mountain goat really isn't a goat at all. In fact, science has no idea what the mountain goat is. Based on the evolutionary charts of the genus and the species, the closest members of any species that science can attribute to the mountain goat is the antelope and an ox. Okay. Basically, you're trying to tell me that they're a ridiculous mix of a 90-pound antelope and a half-ton ox. Okay. Really? We'll go with that. Science's best guess as to what a mountain goat is was a springy cow that dances on the top of mountains. I'm confused. Although, it's a little bit intrigued now. So I continued studying and found out that the mountain goat really is a truly unique and amazing animal. See, the reality is they're not especially quick or fast. And considering where they live and the lack of food sources, they're actually amazingly large, with an average adult male growing over 250 pounds. To put that in perspective, it's the same size as a baby elephant. Mountain goats are lauded in every article I could find for their balance. And along with that balance came a mention of their special hoof design. Now, when I looked it up, their balance was undeniable. A mountain goat is said to be able to turn its entire 250-pound body in a complete circle, standing on a rock that's no bigger than 12 inches in diameter. And that's insane. I'm not even going to stand on that rock. So, with that kind of balance, I needed to find out more about these special hooves. What I was able to find out, what I read in every article, agreed that they were special because they were split in the middle and had a thick pad on the back. Okay. I mean, in my logical mind, that makes sense. Split hooves would provide us a wider base, right? They provide more surface area for the mountain goat to have balance on and to touch. And they should have better stability. So these special hooves must belong to only those animals that lived on the highest ranges or rocky terrains, right? And that only makes sense if that's what they're for. Well, we mentioned that the mountain goat was the only member of their genus. But when we go up a higher level to their tribe, I was surprised to find that every animal in that tribe had the same feet as a mountain goat. Well, that must mean that all those animals live on mountaintops, right? Or rocky areas. No? Out of all the animals that were there, only one lived in a rocky area. every other animal that had the same hooves as a mountain goat lived in grasslands or hill country. Now that's an odd use for those special hooves. So I began to look a little bit further. Maybe there were other animals that shared the abilities that those special hooves gave to the mountain goat. Not just those in the scientific tree. And sure enough, I found some. A tapir and a pig. Not exactly the hall of fame of the most skilled climbers in the animal kingdom. So let's summarize what we know about the mountain goat so far. It's a slow, fat, hairy, unremarkable cow deer. Looking further, the natural enemies of the mountain goat are bears, bobcats, wolves, mountain lions, and the golden eagle. Now that is an impressive list of predators. With the enemies on that list, the mountain goat's lack of speed and the surprisingly large size makes them a big, easy target and very satisfying meal when the mountain goat's trying to run away. Now, this is actually the part where we find out just how special these creatures are. Because despite their lack of ability and the Hall of Fame list of predators that's lining up to eat them, more mountain goats die from old age or their own missteps than that entire list of predators combined. And the reason is because the mountain goat lives at a level their enemies cannot reach. Physically, they're not special. They aren't the strongest, they aren't the fastest, they aren't the leanest, they aren't the smartest. And yet, they reach heights that other animals can't even get to, much less live at. Able to transverse more than 1,500 vertical feet up the side of a mountain in less than 20 minutes. No other animal can dare to try to keep up with them. They do have one predator who's able to follow them up to the height of that mountain, and that's the mountain lion. As long as they live above the timberline, they only have one enemy to fear. And this brings us to the second unique characteristic of mountain goats. I said that they were easy targets when they ran away. Well, the mountain goat doesn't like to run away. While they aren't typically aggressive to humans, when a mountain goat is threatened, they are known to ignore the flee part of the fight-flee instinct and instead just turn to face their enemy. Even when in battles with other mountain goats, they don't ram heads like other cows or deer or rams or sheep do. The mountain goat instead aims their horns at the soft part of the body, trying and intending to end the fight as quickly as possible. See, mountain goats don't play around with danger. They simply eliminate it. This boldness means predators, even the ones far superior like the mountain lion, have to get behind the mountain goat to defeat it. This slow, fat, unspectacular animal has been witnessed fighting off attacks by wolves almost twice its size. Obviously not a 500-pound wolf, a smaller one. See, they don't turn away in battle. That's the grasshopper's job. The grasshopper jumps away. Instead, the mountain goat meets whoever dares to face him head on. If the road is rough, I'm going to get up that mountaintop in 20 minutes' time. Listen, when we need some Christians that say it doesn't matter how rough the road is, if there's a need at church, I'm going to be there to help. If there's something going on, I'm willing to go there and do it. The mountain goat's willing to look the lion right in his eye and not back down. Listen, there's a reason that the armor of God doesn't cover the Christian only in the back. It's because we are meant to look the enemy straight in the eye and not turn and run. The Bible says the devil is like a roaring lion looking for whom he may devour. That means he can't devour everyone. What that tells me is he knows he can't beat you head on. We're only in danger to the enemy when we turn our back. See, listen, it's these characteristics that we see in this conversation between Caleb and Joshua. Caleb wasn't some spectacular species of a man. He was an 85-year-old geezer who didn't realize that his time was supposed to be over. His time was supposed to have passed. But it didn't matter to Caleb that he was too old for a war. It didn't matter that the air on the mountaintop was supposed to be too thin for his old lungs. It didn't matter that he would face a mountain full of giants manning impenetrable mountainside fortresses. All of this just kept adding up to mean to Caleb that he could not fail. Why? Because that mountain was his inheritance. If that mountain was impossible for him to take, that meant that God was going to have to fight for him, and that ensured his victory. If he couldn't make it up the mountain, then God was the one who was going to give him strength. The thin air didn't really matter to Caleb because there was a breath of God that was flowing through his lungs. He may have spent the last 40 years in the wildernesses of his life, but all it did was strengthen his resolve. All it did was teach him how to trust God and how to walk with God. See, Caleb was one of the last two that came out of Egypt. So Caleb was a slave. But it was in the wilderness that he learned how to be a warrior. The bigger and the better that mountain became in his eyes, all it meant was the bigger and better the blessing was going to be. That was his mountain. The bigger it was, the better it was. That was his blessing. The harder it was to take, the better it was going to be. He knew his journey couldn't end until he received his promise. Until he received his inheritance, he couldn't lose. Because his promise came from God. Caleb knew who he was, and he knew he wasn't called to live in Egypt. He knew he wasn't called to live in the wilderness. There was a seed planted in his heart, and he could not be satisfied until he reached the level that he was called to. I hope there's somebody in here who understands what the end of this fast means. It means it's not time to be satisfied. The end of the fast is just the end of the wilderness. Isaiah 58:6 says, "Is this not the fast I've chosen? To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke." For 21 days we beat down our flesh. I don't care if you didn't make it through the whole fast or not. For 21 days together we have beat down the flesh. For 21 days the enemy has attacked us like a pack of wolves, trying to instill fear, trying to instill doubt. For 21 days we've traveled this wilderness path together. But no! Now the bands are loosed. Now the burdens are released. Now there is freedom. Someone needs to understand we don't have to live in the grasshopper mentality anymore. You don't need to be controlled by the winds and currents of life. Fear and doubt doesn't have to drive you around. You no longer are bound to the wilderness. The fast breaks the yoke. But the question is now, what will you do with your freedom? What will I do? Which way will I choose to go? See, the fast defeats a grasshopper mentality. But what we do next determines whether we head back to the fields to fill our bellies or fulfill our call to the mountaintop. We can't be satisfied with a 21-day accomplishment because we are standing at the threshold of an open door. Behind us are the plains, but ahead of us is a mountain. As Brother Lennison said on Wednesday night, we are at the edge of the boat. And do we step out into the water? We can't stop here. Right now is the time for us to take the next step. We are at the edge of our mountain. So what will we do? We're at the edge of our promise. What are we going to do? What's your promise? What's the inheritance God has been calling you to? What's the burden He's placed in your heart?
What's the mountain God said that he would give you? I'm here telling you tonight that whatever God is calling you to, it's yours for the taking. Every barrier has been defeated. It's yours for the taking. It's enough of this piddly-ding patty cake mess. We need some Calebs to stand up and shout, give me my mountain! You see, there was a steely determination in Caleb, but it didn't stop with him. It didn't end there. The next generation took up his cause. In our opening text of Joshua 15, it was Caleb's nephew, Othniel, who volunteered to go next. Maybe it was the thin air that was affecting Caleb a little bit. Maybe his old body was finally starting to wear down. Or maybe he just wanted somebody else to have a little bit of fun too. Whatever the reason is, he said, I want somebody to go take that city. I want somebody. We've conquered this mountain, but there's still a stronghold. I want somebody to go take that stronghold. See, what Caleb was saying is, we aren't going to give the enemy a foothold. We're not going to allow him on this mountain in any way, shape, or form. But I want to know, who else wants this mountain as bad as I do? Who else is willing to fight? Who's going to fight with me? Who's going to fight for me? And most of all, who's going to fight after me? Listen, it isn't enough for Bishop to take his mountain. It isn't enough for Pastor to take his mountain. The question is, who will fight with them? Jesus. Can I have the musicians come and ask you to stand all across this place? Jesus. Coming out of this fast, Pastor, we need a Joshua. Elders, we need some Calebs. But listen to me. Every other person across this place, if you don't fall into one of those categories, we need some Othniels to stand up. That's me, and that's you. It doesn't matter your age, it doesn't matter your position, it doesn't matter your status. It's time to take your mountain. Young men and young women, it's time for you to get involved in the fight. It's not time to watch the Calebs take the mountains. He's asking, who's going to help me? Who's going to go with me? You seasoned veterans, it's time to pick your weapons back up and fight. I know you may be tired. I know the way's been long. But we don't retire from this fight until the trumpet sounds. Listen, we may be living in the last days and that trumpet may be close, but it's not here yet. I haven't got to the top of my mountain yet. We're not done fighting. Listen, you can feel it all over this place. There's a call on your heart, a call to make the stand and the choice today, to make it right now. Right now is the day. Today is the day. It's time to decide which direction you will go. Will it be to the mountain or back to the fields? We've heard it said a couple times the last couple weeks, but Revelation 3:8 says, behold, I've set before you an open door, and no man can shut it. For thou hast little strength. Listen, mountain goat, you're not strong enough to take on the lion. But you've kept my word, and you have not denied my name. I'm giving you that mountain. I'm giving you that mountain. That promise, that trial, that thing that's been holding you back. I've broken it. You can take the next step. Jesus. This altar's open. Find a place to pray. Find a place to seek God. Determine in your heart and make a covenant with him. I will go forward. I'm not going back. I have been broken. I've been changed. I'm a new man. And I'm taking that mountain. Jesus.
You are always fighting for us. Heaven's angels.